You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
We don't outgrow our childhoods. We just start dating them, marrying them, and calling it love. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shitshow, and I gotta be honest, I had a major vulnerability hangover after last week's episode. And I talked about this on this past Shitshow Saturday's episode, but there was just a whole wave of all different kinds of grief that came up for me. You know, I've always been pretty open about my messy past, embraced it, no shame, but there was just something about going through that experience, regressing in that way while being the host of this podcast and the leader of this healing community. There is still a part of me that's like, girl, you should have been more healed. You should have been further along. What's wrong with you? And I know that there's absolutely nothing wrong with me, and I have zero regrets in sharing it, but major vulnerability hangover. Okay. That was a first for me. I've never experienced that before to that level. Like, I've had vulnerability hangovers when I've like trauma dumped before I like learned how to reel it in, but never a vulnerability hangover from sharing something publicly. But here's the other side of it too, is that I've gotten so many messages and texts from folks who really needed to hear that episode. And so I'm just glad that it's helping people to feel less alone, because my experience was absolutely not unique. Whether it's finding yourself in a trauma-bonded relationship, whether it's, you know, regressing in your healing, whether it's realizing that the healing that you've done has been in your head and not in your body, none of that is unique. And so hearing from all of you makes it all worth it. So today, folks, we're diving deep with a true adult child pioneer, the woman who basically took all of this ACA shit and ran it through a trauma lens before anyone else had the language, in her book, The ACOA Trauma Syndrome, a book that truly changed my life. Therapist, author of a ton of other books, Miss Tian Dayton. And, you know, last week I harped on relational trauma. One of her books is a book for therapists on how to heal relational trauma. And so this is her fourth time on the show, yet somehow we still got some fresh gems out of her. We are going to dig into how she realized that relationships can turn into battlefields when old wounds take over, including in her own marriage, and that moment when she wanted to smash a painting just to make her pain visible. And if you're like me, someone whose family did not go in the same direction as you when you started healing, she's got some real wisdom on navigating that as well. So buckle up, because Tian is about to drop some wisdom on why our love lives can feel like war zones, why healing is a full body experience, and how to handle it when your family's not exactly cheering you on this healing journey. But first, let's talk about why you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. We had a few people join last week, but not enough. So you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, what the hell are you waiting for? Actually, Tian's going to speak to that too, about the importance of being a part of a community when we are trying to heal relational trauma. There is no place out there like this community. We dive into so many different modalities of healing. So this isn't just about the 12 steps. People are talking about all different types of therapy and healing work that they're doing, tons of different resources. We also connect on a much more personal level. We have a lot more fun than any other support community that I've been a part of. You can do this for less than a damn dollar a day. So how about we do that? You can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow or see the link in the bio. Do it now. Next, give me a follow on Insta, on TikTok, at adultchildpod. Last but not least, whatever you do, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all. Well, I can't think of a better guest to have after taking an 8-month much needed break than the woman who has helped so many of us finally put words to a pain that we couldn't explain and given us the tools to start healing it. And the woman who helped to redefine this adult child experience as not just being, you know, dysfunction or codependency alone, but as a legitimate trauma condition. The queen herself, Miss Tian Dayton. Tian.
Andrea.
Welcome.
What a warm welcome. That was a great intro. I've never had one quite like that.
Okay, I can follow you. You let me know if you're speaking somewhere and you want somebody to pump up the room. I got you. You know what? I've never asked you this question. So for my Saturday episodes, I interview members of my community. And the first question I ask them is, what song do you want played when you walk into a room? I'm curious what your answer would be.
Oh, you know what I think it would be actually? There's one by, I think it was Phil Collins. You'll be in my heart. And the other one would be Bette Midler's. Some say love, it is a river. But the you'll be in my heart is my therapist one, because I've worked with so many people over the years. And you know, I see people I've done this deep work with, and I might not know their name, but I know their hearts, you know, I know their eyes. And it's hard to explain to someone that they will be in your heart, you know, that's kind of forevermore, because of this connection you make that is in another time and place, and it becomes a part of you, part of me.
Yeah, I mean, you've probably worked with thousands of people.
Thousands and thousands and thousands.
Okay. So I want to backtrack, and we've talked about this before, but it's been quite a while. And I was hoping that we could go back and revisit that moment where you had that realization that it wasn't just two adults that were, you know, in this relationship, but that it was like two wounded children trying to do marriage.
That moment in the living room after we'd had our daughter, is that the one you're referring to?
Yes.
When we were so angry with each other, and I realized how angry I was, that I was looking at a painting that Brant had bought and wanted, and I wanted to just bang it and to show him that I was hurting. And he was, you know, screaming at me. And then suddenly I realized we were screaming out our pasts, that we were fighting ghosts, that it wasn't just me he was talking to. It couldn't have been. It just not much had happened. It was the past coming out through the trigger in the present. You know, we didn't have ACAs at this time. We didn't have that language, I don't believe, at that moment in time. Trying to think. No, we did not. There had not been the first ACA conference. It hadn't been named by Janet Wojtyts. But I knew that I thought we were dry drunks, because I'd read Vern Johnson's book, I'll Quit Tomorrow. And he talked about the kind of behavior that alcoholics exhibit when they put the substance down but don't get recovery and treatment. And at that moment, I knew we weren't putting a substance down. We weren't at all using anything. But we were dry drunks. We just never had put the substance down. We'd imitated the behavior. We carried the behaviors. And I think that is what it's the hardest to convince ACAs of, is how traumatized we are and how much that needs treatment and how serious it is. Because when we don't get treatment, when we don't get recovery, what we pass down to the next generation is worse. We have the addiction to point to. We can say, I am this way because I grew up with that. Our children don't have that. But they have all the distorted thinking, all of the residue relational trauma, all of the cognitive distortions, the attachment wounds. And maybe an ACA is saying, I just love you to their child. I want to be near you all the time. You don't know how bad I had it. You've got it so much easier because you can talk to me. I don't abandon you. But we're using them to work out our own woundedness. We're using them to meet the needs, the loss, the to not reject us, to curry favor and fawn with our children, because that's what we learn to do with our parents, to get triggered and angry with them when they remind us of the wounded child within us that we are too blocked to look at or can't allow ourselves to feel and own. So we pass our woundedness on to them. It's a dark story, and it's our story, and it makes addiction seem, I was going to say, less complicated, but this is what I'm really saying. We grow up in the emotional atmosphere of an addict's drunken or high or pill craziness, right? That is nothing but crazy, over the top, over the edge, sick behavior that we grow up in. And it's generally unnamed and it's often denied. And so we are making sense of that as reality, not as our parents' drunkenness, but as reality. And that childhood conclusion we come to is what we, you know, whether it's, what did I do to cause my parents' unhappiness, or I must be a big problem, or they wouldn't tell me I'm a big problem, or I can't keep them happy, or whatever the childhood distortion we come to in our child think in a state of high anxiety is, we pass that down like a present that gets wrapped up in childhood, handed off. Frozen, flash frozen, packaged, handed off. So until we unwrap that package, until we thaw out that frozen pain and re-examine those distortions and look at how our attachment patterns are affected, we put the next generation at even a higher risk than we were at. And that is sort of been the thesis of this book, Andrea, that I've been talking to you about, Growing Up with Addiction, that's out in March of 2026. It's not just what our ACA issues are. It's how do our attachments patterns play out in our partnering, in our parenting, in our social life, in our friendships, and how do our cognitive distortions play out in those same areas. So I want it to almost feel like you're reading your horoscope, you know what I mean? Look through the pages and find me and find how I might be acting in these areas because of the way I grew up. And then the point I really hit in the last chapter is get help, get help, get help, get help. Don't minimize the help we need. And that it's not reading a great book. It's not hearing the right podcast. It is hearing the book and hearing the podcast as part of your supports for the therapy and 12-step programs that you and the lifestyle changes that you create with the same vigor and motivation that an addict needs to create to stay sober. We need to create all of that to stay emotionally sober.
Mm-hmm. That's such an interesting point, because I feel like for some of us, we can go through life where it's just kind of this slow burn pain where maybe it doesn't ever get so horrible. And then others of us are just, there's no other option than to get help. You know, like the pain is so severe to where it's no, there's no other option. And I'm grateful that for me, the pain was so great, but it's so interesting how it can, you know, play out either way.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I was like you, the family I grew up in fell apart around me, right? Around me. I was the youngest. And by the time my sister, my brother had left home and my other sister was, you know, I guess 2 years ahead of me, so left that much earlier, my lot was to live in the brokenness, center of the brokenness, which looked like I had the worst deal because my childhood was the most impacted. But over time, I've come to see it's a sort of a gift because I had to look at it. It was everywhere. I couldn't avoid the mess that my family was. So the denial everybody else lived in and continued to live in and pass along,
no qualms about it. Yeah.
It just was everywhere.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you was, so prior to this experience that you had with your husband in the living room, you obviously knew that you grew up in an alcoholic home, but I'm curious, was there any sort of awareness that perhaps your childhood was negatively impacting your life as an adult?
My mother went to Al-Anon. My mother, the story was that at a certain point, a doctor said to my father, "You have to stop drinking. If you don't, you'll have about 2 years to live." We're all, six of us in the living room, and my sister brought that up. She said, "Dad, the doctor said if you didn't stop drinking, you would die in 2 years." I was in about sixth grade at the time, I think, fifth or sixth grade. And I burst into tears, ran upstairs. My father ran up after me. The family kind of was at various stages on the staircase or not on the staircase. And my father was saying, "Look what you've done. Look what you've done. You've made her so upset." Now, of course, this is part of the disease, right? This was the beginning of my awareness that my father had a serious illness. And the next stage.
How old were you? Do you know?
I think I was in sixth grade, maybe fifth or sixth grade, probably maybe sixth. And then my mother, when I was in eighth grade, I think, mandated my father into treatment, which meant in Minnesota in the 1960s, men with white coats came to him and put him in one of those jackets and took him away because he refused to go to therapy voluntarily. So he was there for, you know, a short period of time in a, I mean, time, who knows, but it was a short period of time until he said, "Yes, I will go to treatment." And then he went to Hazelden and he left early. He came home looking like the father I knew, sober and beautiful. And the family, I looked around and realized that no one but me was glad to see him. And I think I was the youngest and I kind of knew the least that he'd left early. And I kind of knew it, but I tried to not know it, you know, or maybe there was a reason. But I do remember having the thought, he will never stay sober in this family because no one wants him to be. So, and that was just the sense I made of it at the time. I sensed that we had nailed him in as the problem and the only problem. And my family kind of froze in that space. We never went through the process of saying, this is what I'm brought to the situation. This is what I need to change. And this is what I need to do to heal. And we've done that to various extents individually. But that part of us, we weren't able, in spite of my dragging us into therapy at least two times as a family, we just weren't able to get underneath it and talk the way we needed to get honest. There was also sexual abuse in my family. So there was just too much to talk about, I think. And people were not really willing to get honest about all of it. We could only get honest about Dad's alcoholism. And that wasn't enough. We needed more honesty, much more. So we have maintained our relationships. We are part of a close Greek family and so forth. But there is that dark strain that got passed along to the next generation that can erupt if we're not careful, that kind of thing.
What do you know about your parents' upbringings?
A lot. A lot. My father grew up on an island in Greece. His father, he was from a Greek family that had a war hero, so a famous name. And that attracted to his father a woman of means, right? So she came in with a large dowry, which is how you marry in Greece, 3 boats, svapori, and he gambled them all away. Clearly, he was an addict and a gambler, right? So he lost everything. They said, don't worry, to my father's mother. He's got a beautiful voice. We'll make him a priest. So my drunk grandfather, clearly drunk grandfather, became the island priest. And I think it, as far as I can tell, it fell to my father and to my grandmother to run the church. And he did his best, but my father knew the liturgy, knew the cantor role, knew the, you know, she managed the money. That I think they kind of ran things. And then my father was sent, you know, at about 16, 15 or so to seminary to become a priest. And probably as soon as he was old enough to take over and be the priest on the island. And this was a kind of a sophisticated island, the closest to the mainland. So when I say a Greek island,
what's it called?
It's like saying Long Island, you know? Mm-hmm. And then dad kept running, jumping the wall. So he finally stowed away to America. He wow. arrived in America with $16 and no language. And he made his way to a successful life. So a lot of trauma there, right? A lot of success and a lot of trauma. And the trauma, I'm sure, was never addressed because he was so busy succeeding. And then bringing his mother here, bringing his sister here, taking care of everybody. And then setting all of them up and blah, blah, blah. And then when he decided he was old enough and successful enough to marry and done being young, and he saw my mother's picture in a Greek newspaper. She came from a good Greek family. He went to Minnesota. He married her. He made a deal with her father, and my mother grew up in, same Greek immigrant who succeeded in Minneapolis. He became the most successful Greek person in Minneapolis for a period of time. Large business. Every Greek who came to town had a job, was taken care of. So I came from people who took care of other people, you know, and Mom had a very sheltered childhood. Trauma in the family. I mean, her father was somewhat violent, I think. Not with her, not even with his wife, but some, probably the boy children. But he was also this big success and this big patron of the community. But her family was actually a great family. But living with my dad was loaded with trauma. Mm-hmm. And she was 19 years younger than he.
Oh, wow.
So typical, again, in these kind of arranged marriages. But he married her for her, the way she looked.
Physical appearance, yeah.
Her physical appearance to her family and her background. So there you go. These are both good people, wonderful people. And I would say my mother looks back and said, we had 10 good years. But she was married for 24, so.
It's better than none, right?
Yeah. But we were the other 14. You know, we also were those 10.
Yeah. So as I said, you know, you're the pioneer of really naming this adult child experience as being a trauma condition. And I know, I think you published the ACOA trauma syndrome in, what was it, like 2012. But I mean, I think you've been writing about this being a trauma thing since the 90s. But I'm curious, like, what was your process in, like, understanding this being complex trauma, like, being trauma? Because nobody was talking about this, right? Like, so you had that experience in the living room, but then how did you get to that this is trauma? This is trauma. This is like PTSD.
Good question. I'm not even sure how to answer it, but I can answer pieces of it. Bessel van der Kolk's work, his first book, I think I read in 1985 or 6 when he published it. It was called Traumatic Stress, I think. And he had a laundry list of qualities that traumatized people exhibited. I looked through the list. We're having some mental health buy-in over the next few years. The mental health field is looking at this book and saying, hey, wait a minute. We see this in our patients also. So that was the mental health field at this point, not the addictions field yet. And in truth, Andrea, the last thing on his list was self-medicate with drugs and alcohol. That's 1985, 67, somewhere in there. Now, I thought, oh my God, this needs to be made clear in the addictions field, where all our addicts are self-medicating emotional pain. It became clear once I understood the literature and sat with it and worked with it. And I was working with addicts at this point. How many addicts are also ACA? So I'm working with addicts. I'm adapting this to my model, because I'm doing program development. So I'm, madly developing stuff that works and trying to get rid of what doesn't work, which is a lot of stuff. Psychodrama was very popular. By this time, I was a psychodramatist. I learned psychodrama from Sharon Wegscheider, who learned it from Cruz, who learned it from Virginia Satir. I later learned psychodrama from Zirka Moreno and became an astute expert in psychodrama and sociometry. Having come into it through the experiential therapy, let's just get this to happen window, doing it kind of off
willy-nilly.
Willy-nilly. And I thought somebody should write a book called Trauma and Addiction. I waited 10 years for somebody to do it and nobody did it, right? And I thought, I'm not the person, I don't feel expert enough. By 10 more years, I thought, I think I could take a stab at this book. So I wrote a book called Trauma and Addiction. And once I did that, suddenly all these conferences were named Trauma and Addiction. And it was the big subject all over in the field because I had made that connection. The next big connection I made is the one you're asking in the question. And I it's funny you're asking me that, and it's funny I don't have a good answer. I think it really was because I understood, wait a minute, what I've experienced in my life, what I see my siblings have experienced, what my husband has experienced, what his siblings have experienced, what every client I have who's in ACA, even if it's underneath addiction, seems to have experienced, fits this category. That I think the reason I don't have a good answer is because I helped develop the category. So to start, I have to go back and say, kind of like Andrea, well, when this symptom hit and when I understood that symptom and when I put that one together, and it wasn't sort of a moment, it was a slow development that became a kind of a, oh my God, what's really happening? And here was my aha. Wait a minute. I understood that a soldier from Vietnam, my generation, would, hit the dirt when he heard a car backfiring, right? Because it reminded him of the battlefield, that was a post-traumatic stress reaction. I kind of coined the idea that our backfiring car is when we try to have adult relationships of our own.
When somebody doesn't text me back after 10 minutes?
Yes. When you feel rejected by your partner. When you feel triggered and make it about everything but what it's about. When somebody does this, when you feel close to them and they go, and you go right back to being that child who's frozen because you don't think you're getting signal. No one wants to hear what you have to say. Right? All those triggers I started to realize were relational triggers. And then Judith Herman had introduced complex trauma but she talked about it as relational trauma, but I really landed it in that space. I said, no, wait a minute, we're just a mess is what I was really saying. We're just a hot mess. And our battlefield, our relationships.
Boy, are they.
Boy, are they. And why can't we seem to have good ones? Why did I see all of that around me everywhere? And I saw it in my own marriage, only we were also very happy. So it was a good, here was my moment of reckoning now. Here, I just found it and I remember it. I was standing in my apartment in New York City and I looked out the window, and I knew a lot about this subject by then, but it was still, we were talking about 1982, I think. So it was still before, no, maybe 85, maybe ACA, because that was 80, no, something in there, 83. And I looked out the window and I thought, I'm married to the man I want to be married to. I was in love. I was happy. I have two beautiful children. I have a beautiful place to live. I know I have the life I want. I am not in doubt about that. Why do I feel dead inside? Why can't I feel it? I thought, I have everything I want. I just can't feel it. And I was aware of this sort of numbing inside of me that I couldn't let in the goodness of my own life. And I think that's what gave me the strength to start all this, because I wasn't recreating all the pain all the time. I actually had created the life I really treasured. I couldn't feel it. I couldn't enjoy it. I couldn't be lighthearted and trust it. And I knew that. And luckily, my husband and I were somewhat different. He was a little more trusting of life in that way. And I was a little more aware of pathology, so we could kind of help each other.
Because you obviously you're still married, you've been on this journey together. Was there any sort of resistance or pushback in getting him aboard this healing journey too?
Oh, tons. I mean, not tons in getting him aboard the healing journey, but just tons of strife in healing together. I mean, when I started my healing journey, I started by when I had this awareness, I thought, I need help and I need to find it. So I found Sharon's 5-day. I was aware she did a 5-day treatment thing. And I carved out the 5 days and lined up help for the kids. And my husband took over the rest of the time. And I spent 5 days essentially doing psychodrama, but nobody called it psychodrama. And it changed everything for me. Everything. And it was the psychodrama that was the magic elixir. It was profoundly healing, embodied healing, talking to rather than about. Suddenly I could say what I needed to say, do what I needed, move, shout, scream, cry. I could get it out and then reshuffle and say, I wish you had been more like this. I wish you'd been like this. I wish, you know, so I could repair with the same roles I had been needing to talk to. The question was sort of, how would you wish it had been? Or I asked myself that. I don't remember how I made it part of my process. But I could see how I would have wished it would have been. And we had fun. Sharon was great at adding fun to her weeks, just great. And she recognized that need of fun. Because ACAs, we stop having fun. We stop being lighthearted. We stop knowing how to have fun. So at this point, I thought, you know, my husband might be fine. I don't know if he's fine. I can't tell because I'm so preoccupied with how unfine I am. I'm going to get help and get better. And then I'm not going to make him a project. I'm going to make me my project. And I joined Al-Anon and I got a therapist. I did everything that was recommended. And the ACA meetings at the time were too intense for me. There weren't many of them and they were such dumping grounds. I needed more good orderly direction and positivity and I didn't want to just blame. I wanted to change. And then after about 2 years, when I felt significantly better, I remember looking at Brand saying, you're a mess too. You know, you got to do this too. And so by then I think had kind of figured out that things had gotten better for me. So I don't remember any resistance in him. I mean, he just signed me up. He went in it, if anything, so intensely that he outpaced me in terms of recovery, everything. And then then there was a moment at which I had to say to myself, I have to be willing to give this up, this marriage up, or because if I'm not willing to conceive of that idea, I don't know how I'm going to change. In other words, I might change and we might not be a fit. So there was that point in healing. And I think we both articulated even being willing to take that risk. I'm not saying we thought it would happen, but I'm just saying there's a moment where you can't say, I'm going to really change. And that journey might go where it takes me. But it turned out we changed and we were able to keep it, you know, moving together well enough, not perfectly by any means, well enough.
What were some common dynamics that would come up for you guys, or common triggers?
Mistrust and transference. I mean, I often, and I still think it sometimes, that Brant's mother was the alcoholic. And there's a moment sometimes if he's talking to me, if I trigger something in him, when I know he's no longer talking to me. He's talking to his mother in the middle of the night drunk, and he's lost, and he's in the transference. And I spent years just saying, Brant, I'm sober as a judge. I'm not your mother. And it just didn't get through, really. I mean, I think what I learned to do is remove myself at those moments and not expect change. Over time, I think that has changed. And for me, I think it's harder to see yourself, right? I think my family style is just to erupt and point the finger. And I think that if I had to ask Brant, I'm guessing he would say something like that about me, that I wanted externalizing it. We both externalize it on each other in different ways, but we both erupt at each other.
You're a crazy Greek.
Crazy Greek, and he's a crazy wasp, right? Can I say they erupt too?
Yeah. I'm curious if you experienced any like pushback professionally from the ideas that you were spouting, like as far as like this, the whole ACOA trauma syndrome. Was there any pushback? All right, Chichos, did you know that scientists now openly say that your gut is the cornerstone of your health? And it's not just about digestion, okay? The gut literally affects everything from your energy levels to mood to weight management and even your longevity. However, an imbalanced microbiome can sneakily sabotage you with constant bloating, sluggish energy, and those stubborn extra pounds that you just can't lose no matter what. But here's the kicker. Fixing your gut bacteria isn't rocket science. It is the game changer for reclaiming your vibe and living your best damn life. And that is where Bioma steps in, delivering powerhouse supplements like their flagship probiotics for killer digestion and weight control, the Feminine Health Symbiotic to keep things balanced down there, and menopause support to crush hot flashes and mood swings. Their science-backed trio of prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics work like a gut reset button, all in vegan, tasteless capsules with a no BS 14-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it risk-free, okay? So go to gobioma.com/adultchild today for an extra 15% off your order. That is gobioma.com/adultchild and get an extra 15% off. All right, Shisha, so I have been talking to you about Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth, the supplement that helps women maintain optimal hormonal levels with over 50,000 glowing reviews from women worldwide, with 98% of them saying they would recommend it to somebody else. Now you can take those results even further by pairing it with their probiotic collagen protein, which helps restore gut lining integrity, promoting overall hormonal balance. It helps to relieve occasional bloating and gas, reduce sugar cravings. It helps you feel satisfied longer, boost your energy. It helps to relieve occasional gas and bloating, reduce sugar cravings, keeps you feeling satisfied longer, boost your energy, and helps you stabilize those damn mood swings. And because your gut directly affects your hormones, improving gut health can amplify your hormone harmony results so you can feel like yourself again. And so I struggle with brain fog. I'm sure many of y'all can relate. And since I've been taking the prebiotic collagen protein, I've noticed a big difference there, as well as just a lift in my overall energy levels. Happy Mammoth is dedicated to making women's lives easier, and that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromises when it comes to quality, and it shows, folks. So right now, you can try prebiotic collagen protein and Hormone Harmony risk-free and get 15% off your entire first order today with code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That is happymammoth.com. Use code ADULTCHILD to get 15% off today. So Shit Shows, the holidays sure do sneak up fast, so it's never too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it instead of scrambling at the last minute and just finding whatever the hell you can find. And Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Good looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. So I just got a friend of mine a laptop cat scratching pad. So it's a scratching pad that looks like a laptop because her cat, like mine, likes to constantly sit on her computer. It's probably not going to help with that problem, but it was hilarious and I had to get it. And then I got for myself, it's called a couch caddy. So confession, I'm constantly losing my phone and the remote in between the couch cushions. And so this is this like beautiful wooden thing that kind of drapes over the arm of the couch. And it has a designated spot where I can put my phone, the remote, a drink. It's the shit. I'm obsessed. And so Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms to dads, kids, teens, book lovers, history buffs, diehard football fans to foodies. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. And I mean it. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/adultchild. That's uncommongoods.com/adultchild for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Not so well, this is
spill it.
You know, the biggest pushback is my own family and my own extended family and my own husband's family. And I would say that the people who come to me for help are already there.
Yeah.
They're asking for help and they're saying, Tian, you figured something out that I
meant like your colleagues, if there was any.
Oh, my colleagues.
In the professional community, I was curious.
Because we were, I've been very lucky to come of age with some terrific people over time. I mean, I have very good close friends in the addictions field, you know, sort of different layers. The speaker layer, you know, we're all on the road and seeing each other and being with each other in all these different states in all these different ways. And we're part of a community. So there's a speaker community, and we've been co-creating this together. We've been sharing information as much as anything else, and admiring each other's research and learning from each other. Within the addictions field, there's this wonderful kind of support. There's some competition, but the people who have lasted are the non-competitive ones. To be quite candid, the people who've really lasted and succeeded over the long term are the ones who share. The people who were competing and looking at the, they've fallen out the sides over time. And then there's the mental health field that is a little bit broader than the addictions field that I've come to work with. And that's more like Bessel van der Kolk or Steve Porges or Dick Schwartz, or we come from different disciplines. Who else would be in that category? Peter Levine, senior fellows at the Meadows. So we've kind of learned from each other, I would say, in a different sort of a way. Because, for example, Peter Levine, you know, somatic experiencing, I've incorporated into the way I do psychodrama. He's incorporated role play into the way he does SE. Same with Dick Schwartz, you know. And Dick is doing something that is role-oriented anyway. It's internalized, and he's incorporated role play, and I've incorporated some of his wonderful parts thinking. It's wonderfully freeing. Bessel, of course, has kicked down the door in terms of words don't treat trauma. And Bessel loves psychodrama. So we've learned from each other there prodigiously, I think, and all around for all these people. And
I want him on the podcast so bad.
Yeah, he's pretty remarkable. And he just knows his area. He knows his area. He saw it. And I think one of the reasons he knows it is that he had the position of a scientist. Why isn't this working? I would say most of the mental health field and most people spend all their time trying to jam the model they've learned down people's throats, right? It is the creator of a new way of thinking that is willing to stand back and say, why isn't this working? And that's a position I admired and learned to take as a psychologist, was to stand back. Oh, Steve Porges. Did I mention Steve Porges, who is like remarkable and with the nervous system I've learned so much from? But when I was doing so much program development and training of therapists in the treatment industry, I was willing to stand back and say, why isn't this working? And what can I do to get it to work better? And those are the questions that not, and that's the pushback, but it's not necessarily coming at me. I don't feel pushback towards me that much. People who want to push back against me just don't bother finding me or
don't mess. Don't mess with me.
Well, they don't. It's not that they just aren't interested in me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're interested in somebody else.
Okay. So I want to pivot a little bit and I'll start by just saying that. So when I started this podcast and when I first interviewed you, I thought I was so much more healed.
Well, I remember all this.
That I actually was. And I was hoping that you could speak to this idea of regression sometimes being a part of deeper healing. This idea that sometimes we have to, you know, revisit, you know, the same damn wound that maybe we thought that we had healed, or that we have to slip back into old patterns or behaviors, and that we may have thought we had outgrown, and how this, you know, actually is a part of the healing process.
PAs want to get better in their heads.
Mm.
And it's what we call in the psychoanalytic world a flight into health, a flight into healing.
I've never heard that term.
Well, it's a psychoanalytic term, and it's a wonderful one. And it is a flight, because you learn so much and you think, oh my God, I feel so much better knowing this.
Guilty.
And you do feel better knowing this, and you are better knowing this. It's not false. It's just very incomplete and it's very intellectual. And there's a difference between what you know in your head and what you think. I mean, if I had a quarter for every time I've heard somebody shout, I learned this in CODA and I know it, and I this and I that, and I learned and I learned. And when somebody's shouting it at you and trying to shove it down your throat, it's a pretty good indication that they don't know it in here, because trauma lodges itself in the body. And that is why that is my movement towards the second group that I've talked about, who talk about body healing, whether it's Porges talking about the nervous system, Levine about the body, Bessel words don't teach, you know, Dick an internalized kind of family system. Unless you heal the trauma that is stored in the body, you aren't going to heal your spontaneous reactions in life.
Mm.
According to Moreno, who created psychodrama sociometry group psychotherapy, healing, you know you've healed when your spontaneous reaction to the same situation is different. If your spontaneous reaction is the same all the time, the healing hasn't happened. So, of course, this is a journey. Of course, we think we're better, as much as that's a trigger for me when I encounter it in other people, because I just want to say, you know, cool it. But if we can't feel what is shut down, the nature of trauma is that you shut down your emotions, right? That's the whole deal. You shut them down. That's, I talk about that so much in Growing Up with Addiction, that we freeze our emotions. And Steve Porges talks about it. We freeze them in the nervous system. We freeze them in the body until you can. And the models I've created, RTRS, allows us to feel safe enough to unfreeze. And once we unfreeze and we can start to feel, and people have this in meditation too, this experience, if you can sit through the feelings that are arising and not shut them down, and as they arise, witness them, and as you feel and witness them, you make new sense of them, you see them differently. That's what healing is. However you get there, that's how it starts with the body. It starts with what arises out of the body.
Yeah, that's just it right there. You know, I just realized so much of just how the nervous system is everything. And I think I had an understanding. I mean, I intellectually understood that the body keeps the score and that somatic work is important, but it wasn't, yet again, like so many of us, right? That we have to be in excruciating amounts of pain before we're able to, you know, to do the work. And that's what I realized for myself, was like, it was so, my healing up until that point was so, you know, neck and above. It was cognitive and I understood and I got it. But
say more about that for your audience. What did it feel like to understand and get it, but not have it?
Well, I mean, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
Right.
You think you know it all, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just really thought I had it all together. I really did. But I think it's, I'll just say that it's, as somebody who, one, totally blown away at the realization that I even have trauma, right? You know, as somebody who, yeah, I knew my childhood was less than ideal, but then coming to realize, wow, this screwed me up a whole hell of a lot more than I initially thought that it did. So it's like, that's kind of the first thing and the first kind of awareness that you have to tackle. But I then had to be even more humbled to realize really what it was that I was dealing with. I think it took a lot of pain and finding myself back in old patterns to truly understand how this stuff is stored in the body. You know,
how good of you to have the knowledge then to be able to even question whether these are old patterns that are being repeated.
Pretty obvious.
Maybe the knowledge you had and the confidence you built in initially in feeling you were willing to be surprised by your own. I understand that. I've been the same. Mm-hmm. There has to be this willingness and openness. And I think that's what program teaches us. I think, you know, become willing. That's the core, become willing.
Yeah.
To blah, blah, blah. But if you're not willing to see yourself and you know, self-honesty, scrupulous self-honesty, then it's not going to happen. Mm. You know, I think that's one of the reasons I think program is so useful for people. Because the basic tenets, people argue in their heads, well, I don't like the God thing. Some of the people are boring. It's too deep. Well, that's not what program is about. It's about being in a room of people who are also trying their best to allow their feelings to surface and share them and not shout at everybody. And it's just a slow healing. But slow is good. And that willingness and the container, the safety in the container, and the listening to other people, isn't that part of opening and being willing to see? I mean, maybe. I don't even know. I haven't asked you if you go to program, and I don't want to on the air, but, you know.
I mean, I'm my community. But I think that is so important. And the one thing I, you know, promote when I promote my community, you know, I say that this is, you know, relational trauma, and we heal relational trauma through safe relationships. I think the one thing that is really important about being a part of a community of peers is the realizations that you're able to have, because I think it's a lot less threatening to, as opposed to having a therapist try to point something out to you, mm-hmm. versus hearing somebody else share mm-hmm. their experience mm-hmm. and being mm-hmm. able to relate to that and internalize mm-hmm. that. I think mm-hmm. that awarenesses can come to the table a lot easier. And I'm curious what your perspective of that, like, therapy is so important, but I'm curious what you would say as far as like what the importance of being a part of a community of other people who grew up in dysfunction, who are on this same healing journey, and just the kind of the unique opportunities for healing that exists that you can't get in a therapist's office as a part of being a community, and what your perspective is on that.
I think it's core. I think it's that which you should not be without.
Yeah.
I think we heal in community, and we heal slowly, and we don't heal through interpretation. I mean, my husband's a psychoanalyst. Analytically trained people, when they do make good interpretations, they can be just dazzling. You know, I'll be sharing something, your husband will make an interpretation, and it will just unlock something because he's really good at it.
What does a psychoanalyst do?
A psychoanalyst is more Freudian in nature. Or, okay. I mean, he's not a Freudian. He's what they call a self-psychologist, but what I do is experiential. So mm-hmm. I'm My interpretation is in the roles we choose and the techniques I use to move it forward. It's much more client-centered in that way. It's less advice giving and more accompanying someone on a journey of their own. And so I think therapy can also send you down a problematic road if it's not good therapy. One thing I've seen happen in my generation is over empowering the client you have and not taking into account the person they are in partnership with or the family they are affecting, but just, you know, take care of yourself, boundaries, you know, all of this stuff. That I remember one client one time sent me a quote saying, "You can't take care of yourself and another person at the same time." And she said, "This is just a great quote." And I looked at it and thought, oh, and I showed it to my husband and just to see. And he said, "But taking care of yourself is taking care of the relationship." Mm-hmm. And I thought, thank God he said that and I married him, because you can't just see yourself as this isolated thing. That if you learn to state your needs, state your boundary, da 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 da, it all should all work out. You have to be able to co-regulate with other people. We're human beings. Without co-regulation, we're in trouble. Without co-regulation, we don't even breathe normally. A baby learns, if a baby is born without a fully developed nervous system, so they actually cannot regulate their own emotions. And that is why every parent is busy doing this all the time, right? Booing, rocking. So that's how they build their apparatus for self-regulation into their system. If that doesn't change in life, we're mammals, we co-regulate together. So that's where healing in community, that's number one. You need to be around other human mammals to regulate yourself. Being willing now, then you feel safe enough to actually being open to hearing something. Oh, I'm hearing something I identify with. Oh, that could be me. This is how that works for me. So, but the safety is what is first. Now, if you have a one-to-one therapist you feel really safe with, you can be really emotional with, they are not overly interpretive, they don't tell you who you are, they help you discover who you are, you're in good shape. That's an incredibly helpful person. If you have a therapist who's not so good, they can send you down paths that aren't so good. So that you just have to be aware and do what. But I think to resist healing, the problem with trauma is we don't want to take stuff in. You know, it's too scary to revisit mm-hmm. those feelings we've shut down. So we get these arcs of intellectuality and interpretation and grandiosity to defend ourselves. They sound good, but they just keep this world shut down. And they don't serve us.
I just replayed an episode and the therapist that I was interviewing, she made a quote that she said that, you know, understanding and being able to recognize dissociation is probably one of the most important aspects of being a trauma practitioner, and not being able to do so is where, you know, the most damage can be caused. You know, when your client is outside of the window of, like, so far outside of the window of tolerance, and you're not able to notice that, and you keep pushing and pushing and pushing.
I mean, I do think it's a big part of it. I think there are many parts of it, because
yes, obviously,
you know, people can dissociate right in your presence mm-hmm. and you just kind of like it because they're compliant and they're easy to talk to and they appear receptive, but they aren't. But you get a feel for it.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about what all the different things that you have going on?
Sure. This book I mentioned, Growing Up with Addiction, I'm in the second to the last edit. And that should be available in March of 2026. And
what did you want to do differently with this book compared to all the other books that you've written?
That's a really good question, because I was determined to do it differently. And I did. I made my core thesis not just what happens inside of the person, but how are we passing down the pain? Through what dynamics are we passing down the pain? And I also made it my last chapter to say, you need treatment as much as an addict needs treatment. We need treatment as much as an addict needs treatment. Let's not kid ourselves. But I have broken it down. I also want it to be a fun read and a very accessible read. So as I said, it's like looking for your, you know, I'm an Aries. This is my attachment. Looking for yourself in the chapters and looking for your spouse in the chapters, looking for your kids so that you could find yourself in a variety of ways, descriptive ways that immediately helped you see, oh my God, I do that. Oh, boy, that's a characteristic. I'd keep doing that. So it's a lot of breaking things down into very simple, accessible, metabolizable bites. What else did I wanted to do in that book? I wanted to make people feel, not make people, but inspire people to heal, right? To do something about themselves. And not to just put the book down and think they had done something about themselves, but to take the next steps. And then this model that I have been developing for 30 years that I am finally putting into a shape so somebody can get a certificate, I really like it. Hmm. It for the people in working with groups, it will change anybody's group work. It's experiential. It doesn't require the kind of training psychodrama requires. The problem was, Andrea, with psychodrama, and that's what I believe in so strongly, it can be done in a way that's very emphasizing big every act of catharsis and not enough catharsis of integration. It can be done without role reversal, which I think just reinforces the person shouting, and you never reverse roles and find out what it's like to be the person being shouted at. You don't change perspective. You don't use the brilliance of role work to actually shift your perspective. Psychodrama done carefully and in a trauma-informed way is actually very easy to do. But there isn't enough training in how to do it like that. And that's what I'll work on maybe next. I wanted to create a model that empowered the client and reduced the role of the clinician. Because I too have gone to treatment, and it's torture having a therapist who knows much less than you know, and then telling you all this stuff because they feel insecure. And the less somebody knows, the more advice they give you, right? So I wanted to remedy that and put more of the power in the hands of the person, because when I would be at these treatment weeks, I could look around the room and see exactly who I wanted to connect with, who looked like they were in my space and I could learn from. So I wanted to do that for clients, and I did that for clients. Now I connect them with each other, but I do it through a healing protocol. And I also added timelines, because how drilled down do you want me to be about the time?
Oh, as much as you want, lady.
Okay. Well, Andrea, one of the things that happens in trauma is the prefrontal cortex shuts down, the hippocampus shuts down, and the limbic system, where fight, flight, freeze, fawn live, revs up. So we are not thinking about whether to get out of harm's way, right? We are in fight, flight, and we are all action and no thought and no organization. The hippocampus would timestamp things and organize them, create context. The prefrontal cortex would think about what is happening. So we learn in our alcoholic families to fawn, to freeze, to more fawning and freezing, because who can fight and flee as a kid, right? Where are you going to go? In your footy pajamas with your teddy bear.
I would go to the rock in the backyard.
If you look in a room of ACAs, ask them all where they went. I would go into closets. We all have a place we go. But the other place we go is this dissociated place that you mentioned earlier. We freeze and we dissociate. And so in therapy, when you get near those feelings, you can dissociate all over again. Mm. But what you need to do is be able to feel those feelings. You also need to be able to put them in order. And when I started working with people who've been traumatized, I just noticed, and this is back in the 80s or so, they fogged up. They couldn't remember things. So kind of out of desperation, I started to say, well, write them on a timeline, 5-year intervals. It would come up, and pretty soon the context would happen. And then as they shared, more context. So it became a way to understand developmental attachment wounds. And then I added resilience. So I do a resilience timeline because I want people to also understand the resilience they develop meeting these challenges and to celebrate it, be proud of it, take a hold of it. And the social atom, which is sort of a family map, is a way to look at the family of origin or to look at a frozen moment or to look at a moment in time when you felt great about yourself or horrible about what was happening and who was there with you. So you understand the context in which something occurred. And then once you work through that, you can reshape it. How do you wish it had looked? How do you wish it had been? And oftentimes that's a very emotional moment. People really cry when they say, but it's a grief response and it's a good response because you're letting in the possibility of something new. It made you a little sad to even think that, correct?
Yeah.
For a moment?
Mm-hmm.
May I ask?
No. I wasn't upset. No.
Oh, no. No. I just noticed the look in your, a look of empathy in your face that you understood.
I'm just thinking about wishing.
Wishing something had been different.
Yeah.
Right? It addresses that wound because, you know, we really can't go back and change what was, but we can change the way it lives inside of us. And that does change the way it was and the way we will reshape it and experience it and create it in our own lives. And that kind of change is extremely important, that repair. And floor checks, Andrea, are my most proud thing that I are not Moranian. I just figure them out by creating a process that gets the clients in charge of their own experience and makes the therapist the keeper of the safety and the process, but not the source of wisdom and all of that stuff. That the group is the source of the wisdom. And of course, I understood that by being a 12-stepper myself. Because if you spend as much time in those community rooms, you know what community has to offer you. And then there are more and more communities, it seems to me. There are these pathological communities cropping up all over the place, but there are healing communities cropping up all over the place.
Yeah, you know what triggered me is that, you know, the wishing that things were different. It was just thinking about, you know, the experience of my family just over the past 10 years and the unique kind of grief that comes from watching at one point, you know, semi-functional family slowly fall apart over time, you know, where things didn't start off as, I mean, don't get me wrong, they weren't great, but like when things didn't start off that quote unquote that bad, but to watch the over time, the dysfunction deepen, you know, and just kind of the unique kind of grief associated with that of not just only trying to heal from, you know, childhood wounds, but also the grief of like losing what once was, you know?
You know, I don't know if I'm on the right page, but I have come to the conclusion that we all have a sort of an ideal family living inside of us because the innocence of childhood preserves that.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are many moments in time when there is no place we would prefer being than in the family we are born into.
Mm.
And no other, you know, that there is something that feels so profoundly holding and beautiful about it. And that dream has to dissipate for everyone, right? I mean, that is part of growing up to realize that perfection is not possible. But love is perfect. Talking things over is part of love. And a desire to remain honest and connected and caring is part of love. And that is also what we lose in dysfunctional families. We can't talk things over anymore. We can't support each other in anything but what the idea we have in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to be crossed and we don't want to have our denial broken. So then the family just gets, people get stuck.
Yeah, or further, sicker and sicker.
Well, I think that is what happens, right? If you can't work through this stuff, it just makes you sicker because you lose flexibility of mind and you lose openness.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, life it doesn't let you jam your ideas into place and just get it to work out just the way you want.
Yeah. I mean, you've talked to you. I mean, it's one of my favorite quotes ever of yours is in Emotional Sobriety, where you just talk about how when one person names the dysfunction, you know, that they naming the dysfunction isn't, or the dysfunction itself isn't the sin that naming the dysfunction is. And yeah, it's just really
in this other book too. It's terrible. I'm sort of, it's awful to be.
I think it's the most, yeah, it's the most painful. Insidious
that's the
aspect.
Resistance I have had in my life is as the whistleblower in my own family. And it brings down the pathology of the whole family on you because you're naming it. And everybody else who's acting it out gets off scot-free. And but it in a sick family, it is naming the pathology that gets you into trouble, not being pathological. That's
and
what
you're
talking
also
about.
Yeah, and you're also front-facing like me. So there's like an added layer of that too, where it's like, you know, I'm talking about these things publicly. So it's
an
interesting experience, you know?
I've been very careful talking about things and, you know, I edit things out of my books that my family might have trouble with. And finally, I'm just at an age where I'm talking about most of it. Not all of it, most of it.
Me too. Yeah. I, you know, when I first started the podcast, it was like, I'm not going to talk about anything really current or present, but as time has gone on, I've opened up more about it, and it's not so much to, you know, I'm not trying to throw anyone under the bus, but just so that other people who are experiencing the same, you know, can feel validated. But yeah, I mean, the abuse, it's become much more overtly abusive towards me. And but at the same time, I can imagine the shame of having a daughter who's sober and healing and has a podcast and a community that is, you know, bringing about healing and awareness, and to be doing the opposite. Like, I can imagine that the shame there is quite intense.
That's very mature of you.
Yeah. So I have compassion for that. But then also, I have a lot of compassion for all the parts that are really fucking pissed off too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good for you. I mean,
it's sad.
It's, yeah, I get it.
It's really sad. Well, this has been amazing. I just want to say on behalf of all of the ACAs out there, I'm forever grateful your contributions. I hope that you're able to, I mean, geez, I've only been doing this for a little while, and I've only had a small fraction of the impact that you have had. But I know that sometimes for me, it's hard for me to sit in the awareness of just the impact that I've had. And I really hope that you're able to take a moment right now and soak it up, because I'm sure you don't feel it as much as you should.
Oh, that's
seriously. Seriously. This is like big stuff, like huge stuff. You've changed so many lives. Helped so many people to be able to help
freeze.
Other people.
Brain freeze. Thank you. I'm going to replay the segment. Yeah.
Seriously,
I would love to be able to take that in. I really sincerely would love to. And I can at certain moments. And then
I get it.
You know what I think it probably is I have some notion that if I'm not perfect, if everything around me isn't perfect, I shouldn't take it in. I didn't know where that, something blocks me from.
Well, that's actually interesting. I wanted to ask you this, and sorry, we're wrapping it up, but I do want to ask you this one question. Where has imposter syndrome shown up for you, like throughout all of this, right?
Yeah, I think two places that are occurring to me right now. In the beginning, when I started talking about this, it was like I had the opposite of imposter syndrome. I thought, if I can't talk about this, knowing that I really have in my life what is great to have in your life. You know what I mean? I really have a good life. And I don't feel ashamed of particularly my own. I never was an addict. I haven't had a big stuff to get over in that way. But I thought, if I'm not willing to talk about this and get honest, then how could I ask anybody else to, you know? So that gave me a lot of permission, because I think I felt I had a lot of runway before I had to be perfect, because I was good enough, you know? But I think now I feel, do I feel like an imposter now? Not in my own life, but I just want, what I care about now is how are my children doing? How are my grandchildren doing? How are the lives I've affected doing? And luckily, they are mostly doing quite well. But I want them to be perfect to prove that to me that, you know, I did everything right. And it's very hard for me to think. It's not hard for me to accept, oh, I wish I had done this differently. I made a mistake here. I just want it not to hurt them. It's not hard to own it. I just want it not to have caused damage. And that is, if that's imposter, I don't know, but that is my sincere hurt. If I've hurt anyone and if I've caused damage. And I think I've avoided megatons of damage, you know, because I look at my beautiful kids and stuff like that. But I can't control it all the way down the generations, and I want to. I want everything to be perfect for everyone.
Yeah, and it's also the realization of, like, it didn't start with you, right?
Oh, never crossed my mind, Andrea. I mean, it crosses my mind all the time. It didn't start with me, but I don't blame. Quite honestly, I am in such a forgiving place with my parents. I have so let go of that stuff. But I do have to remind myself of how damaging it was to have them as parents. And that just make it okay for myself that I can know that and still feel the love and forgiveness and the deep gratitude for the happy child I feel I did have. But until I did trauma work, I had no happy childhood. I couldn't remember my childhood. And that, you know, it's, I talk about that in the last chapter of this book, that, or somewhere in this book, that the idea of people when I was in first in recovery would wear these buttons around saying, "You, it's never too late to have a happy childhood." And I wanted to scream at them.
You wanted to puke?
It's too late. You know, forget it. It didn't, you know. But now I know what that means because I remember my happiness and I feel it all the time. And I want that for my children and grandchildren. But I realize now in just saying it, you've really helped me actually, because they have more than I had. So of course they will have this feeling I have today. I want them to feel good the way I feel, you know?
Well, they are lucky to have you as a mom and a grandma.
You're a sweet lady.
And we're lucky to have you on this show, and we will definitely be having you back, and we're going to dive into this book more. Can't wait to read
it. I always love coming with you on this podcast. It's always
the best.
It's always the best. I really love what you've done, what you're doing.
Thank you.
And being a part of it.
I love having you be a part of it.